It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
From the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., backed by the trusted voices of Team Fox. Team Fox. A clear, fresh voice cutting through the noise to tell the truth. It's the Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
It's Monday, March 25th, 2024. It's a brand new broadcast week here on the Guy Benson Show. I'm Guy Benson, your host. Thank you very much for tuning in every weekday, 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time, then around the clock for free on demand on our podcast, GuyBensonShow.com or FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. So very pleased and honored that you are listening. I'm political editor at TownHall.com. I'm a Fox News contributor. And on this fine program that I'm honored to host, we have a great lineup today. Josh Krasauer, later this hour, will be here. Juan Williams in the next hour. Andy McCarthy, who got a shout-out from Donald Trump today during a press conference, he'll be here to talk about that and more in our final hour just past 5 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. That is all ahead. Something happened earlier today that is very disturbing to me. The Biden administration at the United Nations Security Council declined to exercise its veto power as a permanent member on said council to block a resolution calling for a ceasefire, quote unquote, in Gaza. This was a resolution that was adamantly opposed by the Israelis. There was a vote last week on a U.S.-backed resolution that I still wasn't a big fan of, but at least was better in a lot of ways. China and Russia vetoed it on behalf of their fellow, like, access of evil allies. That's the long and the short of it. The bad guys in the world stick together. So China and Russia had Hamas's back last week. And then this week, the U.S. had an opportunity to have Israel's back, in fact, just today. And the Biden team decided that they were going to step aside and not use their veto. They would abstain courteously and allow the resolution to pass. They could have stopped it. It's amazing. At the White House today, I saw John Kirby said, well, we couldn't support the resolution because of some of the language. They didn't vote yes, but they abstained. They could have voted yes, they could have voted no, they could have used the veto. Instead, they just abstained, clearing the way for this so-called ceasefire resolution to pass. Israel is extremely upset about this. Understandably so. Israel was willing to go along with the U.S. resolution last week because of some better components, including tying directly a temporary ceasefire in Gaza with the release unconditionally of all the hostages being held by Hamas. Dozens of innocent people who have been held for months against their will by terrorists who were captured in the process of 1,200 murders occurring on Israeli soil. Remember that, October 7th? I know a lot of people pretend like it didn't happen. That's where the discourse has gone. The new resolution that passed today in the UN Security Council, I mean, the UN is just a hopeless, anti-Semitic, anti-American, anti-Israel cauldron. That's what they are. But the U.S. still has this permanent veto power, which Biden could have used, and they decided for political reasons not to. The resolution that therefore passed today separated out the issue, where they said, okay, we demand a ceasefire in Gaza, not just Rafah, but all across Gaza. And separately, it would be nice if Hamas would release the hostages without conditions. We know they're not going to do that. In fact, the Biden team is pressuring Israel immensely to take a different deal. Listen to this. Where Israel gets an unknown number of remaining living hostages back, Hamas says they don't know or won't say how many of those are left. Right? Hamas can tell us down to the puppy who is killed within 2 seconds of a supposed Israeli airstrike. Oh, yeah, that killed 1,762 children and puppies and women only. They put that out in their little press release and the media runs with it. But in terms of the hostages, very high-value strategic hostages that they stole months ago, like, oh, we cannot tell you how many of them there are. We don't know. We don't know where they are. We don't know if they're living. That's the Hamas position. But Israel, supposedly under this deal, being brokered by the Biden team, would get back those hostages. And in response, all Israel has to do is empty their prisons of terrorists to the tune of about 700 terrorists and convicted murderers and other criminals that Israel has captured and prosecuted and convicted through the years, including terrorists convicted of murdering Israelis. They get to walk free, hundreds of them, in exchange for an unknown number of dozens of innocent civilian hostages. This is what the Biden team is trying to pressure Israel into accepting as a hostages for terrorists swap, a few dozen for hundreds, completely lopsided, completely perverse. Israel has initially agreed to this. Hamas is still thinking it over because they have all the leverage. As long as the Biden people are going to give them more and more leverage and put all the public pressure on Israel, what a boon, what a gift to the terrorists of Hamas. Biden's putting way more pressure, it seems, on Israel, the supposed ally, than Qatar, the regime that's harboring the leadership of Hamas. So it is just breathtaking to me that in this context, and this just happened earlier today, where the Biden administration is leaning heavily on Israel not to go into Rafah, the last real stronghold of Hamas in southern Gaza, that city. I have sound to play later here of Kamala Harris, who says that she studied the maps, guys. She studied the maps. And Israel would make a huge mistake, she said, of going in and finishing the job against Hamas, the terrorists who attacked them. That's the official position now of the Biden administration, that Israel should not finish the job against Hamas, should not go into Rafah, and should accept a few dozen hostages for 700 hardened criminals and terrorists. Those are the things that Biden is pressuring the Israeli government to do. And in the process, the Israeli government said, okay, can you please veto this resolution at the United Nations, which separates out the hostage situation from the ceasefire? That's not acceptable to us. And the Biden response apparently was, no, pound sand. We are going to walk away from you and stab you in the back and then pretend like we're not in favor of the resolution by saying that we oppose it but not voting against it, just abstaining. I mean, just the fence straddling here, where they're trying to have it both ways. I saw John Kirby today said, no, we still have Israel's back. Do they really? Doesn't feel that way to a lot of Israelis, especially after today. I mean, you can envision how this would easily work. The Biden team, even if they wanted to abstain on the resolution, they could say, let's throw the Israelis a bone. Let's veto this thing again. We can say it is interfering with an active negotiation on the hostage front with the Qatari government, and a lot of people are involved there. So let's just veto this and make the Israelis happy, not add legitimacy to this ceasefire resolution, which is deeply, deeply flawed. And we can say we're working on a hostage deal over on the side. That's our focus. That's why we vetoed this thing. But they didn't even do that. They threw the Israelis under the bus. Despite a threat, a warning from the Israeli government, Netanyahu said, if the U.S. is going to allow this ceasefire resolution to pass, then we are going to not send a delegation to Washington, D.C. to talk about Rafah. This is the other fun little detail. Joe Biden, our president, had requested from Israel a delegation, including Ron Dermer, to come over to Washington, D.C., to try to persuade Israel not to go into Rafah and not to finish the job against Hamas. This is the official position of America. don't finish killing the terrorists who murdered a bunch of your people, who are genocidal and promise to keep murdering your people. Don't finish that job. And they wanted to lobby the Israelis in person. No, we're not going to come to you. You come to us, and we're going to tell you what you shouldn't do in Rafah. So Netanyahu and the unity wartime government, the whole coalition, said, okay, fine, we'll send the delegation over to talk to the Biden team. Then they got wind of this resolution at the UN, and they said, look, if the Americans are going to let that pass, then the Biden-demanded delegation isn't going to happen. And Biden said, screw that. They abstained anyway. The resolution passed, and guess what happened? The Israelis said, okay, fine, we're out. The resolution passed, and the delegation is no longer coming. With allies, quote-unquote, like this, in the Oval Office and in Washington, D.C., who needs enemies from the Israeli perspective? What the Biden administration is telling the Israelis is, number one, we don't have your back in the hyena's den of the United Nations, one of the most appalling concentrations of anti-Semitic, anti-Israel fanaticism on the planet happens to be on our soil. We're not going to have your back there. We're not going to veto the bad resolution, even though we had a better one. China and Russia killed that one last week, so we're just going to let that happen this week. We're going to let it play. We don't care about your red line. We don't care about your ultimatum. Basically, middle finger there. But also, we need you to give up hundreds of terrorists over to Hamas to hopefully get back the hostages. Oh, and we also are going to need you to not go into Rafah and finish Hamas. We're going to need you to not do that also. And then they rush to the microphones and say, but don't worry, we still have Israel's back. They are trying for a general consumption to tell the American people that America stands with Israel because the American people stand with Israel. That's the reality, thank God, based on all of the polling. However, there's a very loud fringe of the Democrat base. Hardcore leftists, communists, Islamists, who have been vocally pro-Hamas, or at least Hamas sympathetic. Certainly anti-Israel, with a lot of bigotry mixed in. This is an important constituency in Democrat politics, and the Biden team, they're very worried about losing Michigan. Maybe looking soft in Minnesota, where some of these key voting blocks live. And so they're constantly thinking to themselves, so obvious, it's not subtle at all. How do we sort of keep staying with Israel to keep most of these people somewhat satisfied while also placating the Hamas crowd within our party? And the result is this incoherent mishmash, this mess, where, quote, we stand with Israel except when they need us at the United Nations and except when they're telling, when we're telling them, don't go in militarily on an offensive to finish and end Hamas in Rafah. And when we're telling Israel, you need to get the hostages back, and in order to do that, sorry, you got to free hundreds of terrorists. I wonder where those terrorists are going to go and what they might try to do. We know how this ends. So do the Israelis. And yet they get all this lecturing, constant lecturing from the United States in a world that's already quite inhospitable to the lone Jewish state. A lot of people in the world don't like Jews who defend themselves or fight back. The United States, we are supposed to be an exception to that, a really important one. And the Biden administration is certainly not acting like it, particularly today with this UN stunt. It turns my stomach. And they did it because they're obsessed with the international community and the process of diplomacy or whatever.
Always fresh, always fair. The Guy Benson Show.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Stay on top of the latest news and information from Fox News. Listen and download the Fox News Hourly Update on your time. The trending stories you need anytime you want it. Listen and download now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
I'm Guy Benson. We are back. Just before the break, I was talking about the seeming incoherence of the Biden policy on Israel, typified today at the United Nations, not vetoing something that Israel really opposed on this flawed, deeply flawed ceasefire resolution, but then abstaining. So not actually doing the thing, weaseling away, we abstain, we're going to let it pass, but then we're going to say that we didn't support it. Just a mess. And it's because they're trying to keep up the appearances of being mostly pro-Israel while giving various concessions and sops and dramatic gestures for the pro-Hamas elements of their base, because they're worried about pockets of voters in some key states. I mean, that is the cynical reality of it. And then it starts to at least make some sense. Makes me sick. I think they're the exact wrong priorities for the wrong reasons, but that's what they're up to. And again, they're not fooling anyone. Pro-Israel people who are dialed in are furious about this, rightly so, righteously so. And the pro-Hamas or Hamas-sympathetic crowd, they're not satisfied with little half-measures like this. They want Israel annihilated. They chant eliminationist slogans in the streets. They're not subtle about what they want. No two-state solution. Palestinians taking over the state of Israel, which would cease to exist with massive death and ethnic cleansing. That's what they want. So an abstention at the UN isn't going to win a bunch of goodwill from people to whom you shouldn't be pandering in the first place. I mentioned the Vice President, Kamala Harris. She went on ABC News yesterday. She had another lot more tough talk for Israel. You better not go after Hamas in their last remaining stronghold of Rafah. That'd be a huge mistake because in Cut 18, gang, she has looked and studied the maps.
We have been clear in multiple conversations and in every way that any major military operation in Rafah would be a huge mistake. Let me tell you something. I have studied the maps.
Oh, okay.
There's nowhere for those folks to go. And we're looking at about 1.5 million people in Rafah who are there because they were told to go there, most of them. And so we've been very clear that it would be a mistake to move into Rafah with any type of military operation.
Are you ruling out that there would be consequences from the United States?
I am ruling out nothing.
Yeah, well, there was a consequence today already at the United Nations, where effectively the U.S. took the side of Hamas, certainly the side against Israel. And now Israel's not sending the delegation that Biden requested to talk about Rafah and how Israel shouldn't go about its necessary business in Rafah. By the way, those folks, the innocents, could maybe go to Egypt. That would be one place for them to go. Oh, the Egyptians won't allow that. I wonder why. They could be evacuated to the greatest extent possible out of there. But Hamas operates among civilians on purpose. It's what they do, to make it as hard as possible for Israel so that the international community puts up exactly this kind of fight that we're listening to from the vice president. That's Hamas's whole playbook. And to see the U.S. government playing into it is just revolting. How about this? Release all the hostages and surrender. There's your peace process. Instead, the pressure's on Israel. It's gross. We'll be right back.
America is listening to The Guy Benson Show.
Thanks for being here. I'm Guy Benson. It's The Guy Benson Show. GuyBensonShow.com, our online home. Podcast always free. With us now, Josh Krasauer, Fox News Radio political analyst and editor-in-chief of Jewish Insider, a regular here on the program. Josh, hello.
Guy, happy Monday. Great to be back with you.
I was just talking at the open of the show about Israel and what happened today at the United Nations and all the fallout from that, this canceled delegation and so on and so forth. I want to return to that in a moment. Before we get to that, though, just a couple topics for you on domestic electoral politics. Number one, a big picture question, then a zoom in question. on fundraising numbers, setting aside Trump's legal fees and all of that, we'll get into it with Andy McCarthy later on in the program today. If you just look at the data, you look at the fundraising totals in terms of the Biden campaign and the DNC versus the Trump campaign and the RNC, I mean, it is, you might call it a bloodbath, as a matter of fact. It is a blowout. The Democrats are raising way, way more money than the Republicans, which is not surprising. Democrats are the big money in politics party now. They almost always outraise and outspend in aggregate the Republicans. It's been that way for a better part of two decades at this point. But the gap is really pronounced in this cycle so far. I have heard, Josh, arguments on the right saying, well, it doesn't really matter because Trump got outspent 2-1 against Hillary Clinton. She and her allies spent hundreds of millions of dollars more than the Republicans did. And because of the mood of the country and other reasons, obviously Trump won that election. So money doesn't mean what it used to. That's one argument. The flip side of it is I think so many of the mechanics of getting people ballots and to vote, the Democrats have it down to a science. It costs money. And they are going to very much be, I think, quite efficient on that very crucial front. And then, of course, there's all the messaging and the ads and that sort of thing. So to blow off or poo-poo money altogether, I think, is also a mistake. Where do you come down and what's your read on this canyon separating the two parties on the fundraising front?
So I think the legal challenges that Trump is facing is directly impacts his financial bottom line. And one question I think that we had about how much money is he going to put into his campaign, he did a little bit back in 2016 when he was getting outraised and outspent by Hillary Clinton back then. He didn't have an issue in 2020 because he was president and his fundraising was actually quite strong. Republican fundraising on the small dollar donors that really have propelled so many campaigns from Trump on down, not quite as robust as we've seen in other recent elections in the Trump era. So I do think there will be Trump will be at a fundraising disadvantage, and he won't easily be able to, you know, make up the difference, the deficit, with his own money. And, you know, he's struggling to make
it's
ends
tied
meet.
Up elsewhere.
You know, and we'll see where these settlements end up landing. He won an appeals victory today. May not have to spend quite as much money out of his, you know. But this is not a good time to be, you know. He's facing a lot of financial hardship because of these legal decisions, these civil cases. You know, but look, I also think message means a lot more than money. And we've seen so many elections in recent years where the candidate that spent the most money or the incumbent that had a lot of money but just was running in a really lousy political environment or had a rough record to defend, that means a lot more in the grand scheme of things than, you know, the exact dollar amounts. You know, I'm actually more interested, Guy, about the super PACs, like how much big money is going into the groups that are supporting Trump's reelection, because, you know, that is where these days a lot of the TV ads aren't coming from the campaign itself, but they're coming from these organizations, these super PACs, where anyone can write a large check and they can finance a week's worth of airtime of that and attack ads against your opponent. And there's a real issue about some of these Republican donors who backed Donald Trump in 2016 and 2020, but maybe back Nikki Haley, maybe back Ron DeSantis in the 2024 campaign, and they still haven't jumped back on the Trump bandwagon, and they may be very hesitant, even if they're supporting Trump, to write a big check for either his campaign or more likely for some of these outside organizations. And that could really have an impact because, you know, that's where, you know, if you're watching like an NFL game in the fall of 2024, if you're not seeing Republican ads, Trump ads, and you're seeing Biden ads all the time, it does make an incremental difference when this race could come down to the small number of undecided voters in those key swing states.
My zoom-in question is about one race right in this neck of the woods in the DMV in Maryland. I think a real headache for the Democrats is Larry Hogan, the popular two-term Republican moderate governor of Maryland, deciding to seek the Senate seat in that state. And there was polling just last week from the Washington Post that shows at this still very early stage, Hogan is up double digits on either one of the Democrats who might run against him. There's a primary that's active. I think that will tighten. I think he's probably still very much the underdog. He says he is the underdog. Trump will be on the ballot. It's a very blue state. But at least for now, Hogan is showing himself to be, you know, independent and quite popular still in that state, could be a problem for Democrats. Then there's this little side story right now getting a little bit of attention where the leading Democrat would-be opponent to Larry Hogan apparently used a racial slur on camera during some sort of debate in the legislature. It was a slur that I had never heard of. It took me a while to even figure out what he said because no one was reporting it, just saying it was a slur. I'm like, okay, what was the slur? So I had to do some research and actually find it. It took me a while. A slur that I had never heard of in my life, but apparently a lot of people said, yeah, that is not something that should be said by a white dude, which he is. David Trone is his name. So he said, oh, I actually meant to say this other word, bugaboo, and I said this other thing instead, and I didn't mean it that way. His opponent in the primary is a black woman. This is becoming maybe a bit of an issue for him. You probably, as a Democrat in a primary or otherwise, don't want racial slur attached to your name. Just an interesting little dynamic that, who knows, Josh, could make a really significant difference moving forward when we look at the balance of power flashing forward to November, where Maryland, at least right now, looks like it's on the Senate map for sure.
Yeah, a couple of important points in that race, Guy. This is the worst field of candidates, two candidates, but this is, if you talk to Democrats in Maryland, they are shocked that they have two candidates this week. One of them is the guy you mentioned, David Trone, who is a congressman who is I think he's the wealthiest or one of the wealthiest members of Congress. He owns Total Wine. If you're from the D.C. area, he has a big, big business that you see in a lot of, you know, shopping malls and shopping centers. So he's basically spending his own money on the campaign. You see ads on DC TV about his campaign and about his, you know, trying to appeal to African American voters and progressives, and we kind of define his candidacy. The problem is he's not raising any money. He doesn't really have a natural base of support, and his record in electoral politics is that he's spent gobs of money, and he's had tough races even with all that money spent. He lost in a primary once, and he got the seat in the House. But he's not exactly a guy who has a lot of organic political support. In fact, a lot of the Democrats in the congressional delegation have endorsed his opponent, who's Angela Alsop Brooks, who no one, if you ask any Maryland Democrat who's not really involved in politics who she is, no one knows who she is. She's a local Prince George's County executive, very little profile. She has a very spotty record as executive in a county that's had some tough times lately. She's had trouble raising money on her own. She's been, you know, usually like African-American candidates are generally like great stories, and you have a lot of great biography to run on. You raise a lot of money. That's been the history with a lot of the candidates, non-white candidates that Democrats have run in recent years. She has not taken advantage of that biography, and she's really not made much of a mark in Maryland. So you have two of these very, very, you know, best mediocre candidates, if not weak candidates. And then you have Larry Hogan, who's one of the most popular governors in Maryland history, who still has strong job approval or strong favorability based on the Washington Post polling. And, you know, he could be running against two very, very weak, damaged Democratic opponents.
Yeah, now, and I guess the front runner is Trone, this congressman. And I said that it was a Maryland legislature debate. It was a congressional debate where he used this word that apparently is a racial slur. And when you Google his name, as I just did, so many of the headlines are about his apology and clarification on a racial slur as this very rich, like central casting, like rich white guy, right, in a Democratic base that isn't super into that these days. So his female black opponent is trying to make hay of this. But as you said, she's not really very well known and not good at fundraising either. So, I mean, I'm not predicting Senator Hogan is a shoo-in. I think it's still an uphill battle in such a blue state. But if you're going to look at things breaking a certain way to make that happen, so far, so good for the Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, it's something of a perfect storm. And Hogan, by the way, he just left the governorship, and he's been running. He was thinking about running for president on an explicitly anti-Trump, independent-minded platform, no labels. He was flirting with for a long time. So his brand, for anyone who pays attention, is not even really that partisan. This is a part of this like no labels, independent movement, and he's a popular former Republican governor. So you couldn't ask for a perfect storm to put this race more than Hogan has. To put this race in play. There's also the issue of Israel, where, you know, if you follow, Maryland is one of the largest Jewish populations in the country. And Van Hollen, the senator, the other senator in the state, has been very hostile, one of the most hostile senators against Israel and trying to condition aid to the country. So that's another issue that Hogan has been really taking advantage of and campaigning against Van Hollen and trying to be kind of a bridge to the moderates in the state of Maryland. That said, this is one of the most Democratic states in the country, and congressional and federal races become very partisan in the end. So I would have a hard time seeing Hogan winning in Maryland. But boy, if there's any set of circumstances that puts this race in play, and I do think Democrats are going to have to spend some money here, that's something that is totally because of Hogan's political background.
Yeah, and it's going to be – look, I tend to agree with you in terms of the dynamics of it, but they're going to parachute in with a ton of money to try to turn this into a nationalized election. The problem is Larry Hogan is a very well-known commodity in the state and well-liked. So the normal things that they're going to try to say about him, I think it will be tougher to make it stick, because he's not some unknowable boogeyman who's just going to be marching in line with the Republicans and Donald Trump in Washington, D.C. That's not the brand that Hogan has in Maryland, and everyone there knows it. So they're going to have to figure out how to message that, and how much resources they need to put in there. And I think he'll be raising good money, and he's got a good message for himself. I think for conservatives, he's, off to my left ideologically, but it's about the best you're ever going to get in a place like Maryland. So it's fascinating to watch, and that's why I wanted to ask you about it in these early stages. Josh, a few minutes left, and I did mention that I wanted to talk about Israel. This vote at the UN today, where the administration is trying to have it every way. They're saying, well, we didn't vote yes on the ceasefire resolution because we can't support it because it has too many flaws. But we didn't vote no and we didn't veto it. We abstained. So it's not really throwing Israel under the bus, but we didn't do what Israel was asking us to do. Biden wanted this delegation to come to try to convince them not to go into Rafah. Now that's been canceled because the Israeli government is very upset about this move at the UN. Obviously, they're trying to pander, at least to some extent, to the Hamas-sympathetic part of their base, which is often quite implacable, and I think an abstention on one toothless vote isn't exactly going to have people doing cartwheels in Dearborn. And so it's like they're doing all these little half measures all over the place and trying to argue, at least in my estimation, out of both sides of their mouths, depending on who the audience is. I'm not sure they're satisfying or fooling anyone. And it very much looks like the relationship between the United States and Israel is not in a great place right now. While Israel is in the end stages of this existential war, I opened the show with this. I'm very upset about it. I wonder what you make of it and what you're hearing, because today felt different. It wasn't just lecturing. It wasn't just finger wagging. It wasn't just threats. This was an actual action taken by the Biden administration to abstain from a key vote in the UN, explicitly crossing an Israeli red line in the process.
So what's interesting about today in the U.S.-Israel relationship is that in the past, in the last 5 months, there have been times when the U.S. has rhetorically distanced themselves from Israel, said things, tried to pander to the left in their coalition. But ultimately, on substance, on the actions in terms of vetoing anti-Israel resolutions at the UN, or not doing anything to hamper the Israeli operations on the ground in Gaza, they've been pretty much aligned with Israel. Now we're sort of seeing the opposite today, where they just abstained instead of vetoing a resolution that, to be fair, like there was some nuance there, and they worked behind the scenes to make the resolution less anti-Israel than it originally was. But the reality is it basically calls for a ceasefire and doesn't condition it explicitly on the release of hostages. It basically has both mentioned in the resolution, but
they're not linked.
There's a lot of diplomatic legalese there, but basically does what they've been vetoing. But the language in this resolution was the type of language that was vetoed easily by the U.S. before, and now they've abstained. So now they're saying, and if you listen to all the White House officials, John Kirby and others, they're saying this is actually non-Biden, this isn't binding, there's no change in policy, they're saying all the right things, but this is a different decision, this is a pretty notable shift in actual action. And I think that the reason Bibi Netanyahu pulled one of his top advisors, Ron Dermer, as part of this delegation, is because he's worried that the actions from the U.S. are starting to get more hostile towards Israel. And what this is all about, Guy, and you mentioned it at the top of the show, Israel wants to finish off Hamas in Rafah. That's, you know, they're 90% of the, they finished off, you know, 80% of the Hamas battalions. The final stronghold for Hamas is in Rafah. And the U.S. has been saying explicitly, we don't want you to go into Rafah. And that's, I don't know how you bridge that gap. Someone's going to, you know, Israel's either going to do it or not. And I don't think, you know, the politics are going to stop either side from, I mean, if Israel, you know, needs to take out the final terrorist stronghold and that Hamas has in Gaza, I don't think the pleading from, you know, certain officials and the votes of the U.N., even though that's what they're trying to send, that send this message to Israel. But I don't think that's going to ultimately make a difference, because ultimately Israel needs to do what it needs to do in its judgment to defend itself.
Yep. It's just very alarming to me that the U.S. administration is voting this way, undermining and stabbing Israel in the back at the United Nations while telling Israel explicitly, don't go and finish Hamas in Rafah, while also trying to get them to agree to this crazy exchange for hundreds of terrorists for an unknown number of hopefully still living hostages. It's just a ton of leverage for Hamas and a lot of hostility toward Israel. You expect that at the United Nations. You don't expect it from the United States of America. But under Joe Biden, in an election year, that's what we're seeing. And we're watching it very closely. Josh Krasauer, Fox News Radio political analyst, editor-in-chief, Jewish Insider. Josh, thank you.
Thanks, Ken.
We'll be right back.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
They also, Israeli officials also argue, this war could end tomorrow if Hamas freed the hostages and laid down the arms. Do you disagree?
I do disagree, because when we are talking about famine, the actions of Hamas should not be tied to whether a three-year-old can eat. The actions of Hamas do not justify forcing thousands, hundreds of thousands of people to eat grass as their bodies consume themselves.
That was AOC on CNN yesterday. Jake Tapper with the question. The Israelis argue if Hamas just freed the hostages and laid down their arms, the war would be over. You disagree? AOC, I do disagree. Because of the famine. Well, if there's hunger in Gaza, who's causing that? Hamas. You can't separate out Hamas from the consequences of the actions of Hamas. Another hour coming up. Guy Benson Show.
A new generation of conservative talk. Right here, right now. Fair, fun, and backed by the trusted voices and reporting resources of Fox News. Fox News. You're listening to The Guy Benson Show. And now, here's your host, Guy Benson.
It's a new hour on The Guy Benson Show, our middle of three. Appreciate you tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com is our website, podcast, on demand, no charge to you every day. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Fox News Alert. The Dow down today, 162 points at the closing bell. The Dow finishing at 39,313. Well, I want to play some sound. This was from late last week, but I think worth revisiting. And it has to do with the video, the images that we talked about on Thursday and on Friday. We had Brandon Judd here. I reacted with breaking news as the video became available on Thursday's show. The really almost riot outside El Paso, Texas, at the southern border, where you had dozens and dozens of illegal immigrants sort of bull rushing the border, assaulting Texas officers, uprooting and casting aside some of the razor wire, and then shoving their way, kicking their way past these officers into the country illegally. Just more scenes of total chaos and aggressive, violent lawlessness. So our colleague Peter Ducey asked the White House, asked Karine Jean-Pierre, for the president's reaction to all of this. I'm sure they would much prefer not to talk about it. And the responses from KJP were quite bad. And I say that even within the context of just her overall body of work, right? She is not good at the job. She's bad at the job, and her boss doesn't give her much to work with. So it's not a great combination. So my expectations were low, and she lived down to those expectations. Ducey asking, I think, a very reasonable question during the back and forth. Of the people who are on video fighting and kicking their way through into the U.S. illegally, were they deported? A good question. Cut 14.
Were they deported?
What, they were apprehended. I can't speak to individual cases. That's not something I can do from here. But they were all apprehended. That's number one. And it, the reason why you're talking about the Texas National Guard, they were there because of the governor of Texas. The governor of Texas put the Texas National Guard there. We didn't put them there. He put them there.
Does she think this is a good point? I'm genuinely mystified by this. So first of all, the question is, were they deported? And she's like, they were apprehended. I don't really know. I can't speak to the specifics. They were apprehended. Well, they were apprehended because, in part, there were a bunch of officials there from the state of Texas cooperating with the Border Patrol. Border Patrol has taken Texas's side in their various skirmishes legally with the Biden administration, even though Border Patrol and the union there, they're under the auspices of the federal government, but they actually want to do their job, which is why they've been pro-Abbott, pro-Texas. But shouldn't the answer, just like to clear away some of the underbrush intellectually here, shouldn't the answer obviously be yes, they were deported immediately? Right, here are people, their very first act in our country is entering illegally. That's been true of 10 million people already under Joe Biden. But then their second act was to assault American law enforcement. So if those is, that's like the 1-2 punch, so to speak, of your big entry into the United States illegally, unlawful crossing, assault against American officials, Texas officials. The immediate response, the immediate reaction, the immediate consequence ought to be you're gone. Like, you are instantly deported. But apparently, either KJP doesn't know if that happened or knows that it didn't happen for some of them. I mean, it should be the automatic assumption. It's like, oh, were they deported? Of course they were deported. Did you see the video? And yet, that's not the response from the White House. It was, well, they were apprehended. Okay, there have been 10 million, well, I guess closer to 8 million apprehensions at the border, and millions of them just get released into the country. They get processed, like, oh, well, they might be asylum seekers. Here's your little card, sir. Show up to court in 2032. See ya. That's why they're coming. Apprehensions without consequence, in fact, the opposite of consequence, breeds more of this. So it's not some big achievement they were apprehended. There were a lot of law enforcement there, some of whom were attacked by these guys coming in. The question was, were they instantly turned around and thrown back on their rear end into either Mexico or their country of origin? That should be an instant deportation. But instead we got sort of equivocation and not really sure and parsing from the White House. That tells you something. I mean, look, the lessons couldn't be any clearer. We know who they are and how they operate. But if they're not going to say, yes, those people immediately get the boot, that's once again revealing. Point one. Point two, then she says, well, again, I'm amazed that someone wrote this in her binder for her thinking that this was a good point, or maybe she freelanced this one on her own. This was some off-the-cuff thinking from KJP, maybe. Like, well, we did see the video of these people assaulting Texas officials, but hey, we didn't put them there. The governor of Texas put them there. That wasn't us, that was him. So maybe take it up with him. We didn't want them there. The only reason they were there to be assaulted by these illegal immigrants is because of Greg Abbott. I'm sorry. Non-brain-broken Americans would say it is completely appropriate for officials, whether from the federal government or the state government, someone with a badge and a gun at the border, to try to block people who don't have a right to come here from coming here. Like when people hear the term border patrol, they kind of envision people patrolling the border and keeping illegal immigrants out. That is what the Texas National Guard was doing down there, doing their best to keep illegal immigrants out, including with physical force standing in their way when they're destroying the fencing, which is what these illegal immigrants were doing. That is what Americans expect law enforcement to do at the border. But it is so foreign, it is so alien to the thinking of the Biden administration, that they're like, well, if you see an ugly scene like that, it's because Texas forced the confrontation by having officials there in the first place. I guess if you took the Biden approach, the Biden-Harris-Mayorkas approach to quote-unquote border security, you wouldn't have officials there. And anyone who wants to walk in just walks in. And then they surrender themselves. And then they get their documents. And then they scatter off to whatever cities they want to go to on flights and buses and trains paid for by you and me, the taxpayer. And really the only problem that they see is that this sometimes gets a little disorderly. They need it to be a lot more orderly, but you certainly don't make it more orderly by trying to stop the illegal immigrants from coming here. She's talking about Texas defending the border like that's some weird dunk on Texas. Oh, we didn't put the officials there to try to stop these people. That was Greg Abbott. Take it up with him. Yeah, he was doing the completely rational thing that we would expect the federal government to do, because actually it's their job that they refuse to do. Someone workshopped this answer, it seems. This is the best they've got. Oh, and I've used the term illegal immigrant a lot in this segment. That might be a bit of a hate crime. We'll talk about that when we come back on The Guy Benson Show. I'm Guy Benson. We're back. You know, on the subject of immigration and illegal immigration, interesting new poll that I want to bring to your attention. Before we do that, let's just walk down memory lane. Just a few weeks ago, President Biden at the State of the Union address, you'll recall, was heckled because he was not mentioning the name of Laken Riley, the nursing student in Georgia who was brutally murdered, according to authorities, by an illegal immigrant who came here against our laws, then was paroled into the country by Biden policy, then went to a sanctuary city, committed more crimes, was released, of course, because it's New York. You don't really have consequences for crimes in New York anymore. Quote-unquote low-level criminal activity. Then he skipped the jurisdiction, went to another sanctuary jurisdiction in Athens, Georgia, allegedly committed more crimes, and had a warrant out for his arrest, and then allegedly murdered in a horrible, vicious way this beautiful young 22-year-old woman. And the president, of course, could not be bothered to talk about that or that example because it's unhelpful to him. So Mr. Empathy was not talking about her or saying her name. So during the State of the Union, he was basically bullied, heckled into doing so. Then he got her name wrong, called her Lincoln twice, went off script because, of course, he wasn't going to talk about her on script, and in the process referred to the killer as an illegal, which was the true scandal in the eyes of the left. I mean, an illegal immigrant murdering an American citizen, that's unfortunate. But avert your eyes, we're going to keep our policies going. But a Democrat president calling the killer illegal, well, that's a bridge too far. So Nancy Pelosi went on CNN and criticized Biden, and other people were putting out press releases and tweets. They were all just aghast, clutching their pearls. Biden, like the next day, was asked, do you regret not mentioning Laken Riley or getting her name wrong or the policies that helped lead to her death? No. Do you regret using the word illegal? Because that's, again, the real scandal on the left, including journalists. Journalists are on the hard left for the most part. And at first, his answer was actually relatively good, that he didn't regret it, because technically, he said, they're not supposed to be here, meaning illegal immigrants. So what an old-fashioned thing for him to say. And then he must have gotten read the Riot Act. because the left wing of his party controls the thinking, the rhetoric, the policy direction on all sorts of issues, whether it's Israel, as we talked about last hour, immigration. I mean, it's amazing how beholden these people are to the hard left flank of their party. So then we got this groveling apology from Biden on MSNBC just a few days later. Not an apology for the failed policies, not an apology for getting Lincoln Riley's name wrong. It's Lakin, Mr. President. None of that. The apology was for the word illegal on MSNBC, cut 16. You remember this.
During your response to her heckling of you, you used the word illegal when talking about the man who allegedly killed Lakin Riley.
An undocumented person. And I shouldn't have used illegal. It's undocumented. And look, when I spoke about the difference between Trump and me, one of the things I talked about on the border was that the way he talks about vermin, the way he talks about these people polluting the blood. I talked about what I'm not going to do, what I won't do. I'm not going to treat any of these people with disrespect. Look, they built a country. The reason our economy is growing, we have to control the border and more orderly flow. But I don't share his view at all.
Yeah.
So you regret using that word?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. He regrets it. And the White House said, well, that wasn't an apology. He just regretted it and said that he shouldn't have done it. And he should have done the other thing. That's an apology, you gaslighters. That's an apology. So he clearly got the memo, got the message. We're not saying illegal. That's a real problem. And, of course, the quote-unquote undocumented people, and they're not undocumented in many cases. They're given documents and told to show up to court. They're given parole documents. They actually have documents. They have documents from their countries of origin in many cases, although some of them ditch it for various reasons to then enter the country without consequence, this country. Undocumented is the made-up term that they've decided is the more politically correct way to describe them, but it's actually less accurate than illegal immigrant. Illegal immigrants, as we heard there from the president, they built the country, after all. He credits illegal immigrants with building our country and growing our economy right now. Like, without them, I guess we'd be lost without all these illegal immigrants. Got to control the flow, just make it look a little bit more orderly. But he will never, this is a promise, his word is to Biden, he will never disrespect illegal immigrants, apparently even the ones who bludgeon American females to death to the point of disfiguring their skulls. We wouldn't want to disrespect them with a word like illegal. Heaven forfend. So that was a whole thing, not that long ago. We talked about it here on the show, a pitiful and outrageous and really infuriating series of events. They're on this other planet where all the woke terminology matters more than anything else and not pissing off this very loud fringe of activists. Well, why do I set the table this way for a poll that I teased? Well, Harvard Harris has a new poll about terminology surrounding this very issue. And wouldn't you know it, 73% of Americans are perfectly comfortable with the term illegal immigrant and illegal immigration. Maybe because it's accurate. Maybe because the immigrants who come to the country in violation of our laws are doing something illegal. Therefore, their form of immigration is illegal, making them illegal immigrants. It doesn't make them non-human or subhuman. I think sometimes the behavior in extreme circumstances feels subhuman, like the Lakin Riley assailant and killer, allegedly. But you don't dehumanize someone by accurately describing their immigration status, which is illegal. As much as that annoys certain people on the left, it is accurate. It is correct. Illegal aliens, illegal immigrants, those are the terms. And the American people are fine with it. Because the American people, writ large, aren't psychos. Unlike the hardcore fringe of the left wing in this country that Joe Biden and his team live in constant fear of and capitulate to constantly. 73%, that is a big number in terms of the American public agreeing on something in a term, but they are shackled to the remaining small percentage of Americans who might have a problem with it, which is why I think there's a big disconnect here. Most Americans say, yeah, of course, it's totally fine to say illegal immigrant. It's accurate. And at the White House, they say, wow, that's a lot of bigotry from you 73%. It's not illegal immigrants. We should never say that. We'll never disrespect someone that way. Haven't you gotten the memo? These are disproportionately Latinx, undocumented people of color, a.k.a. newcomers. That was the new one from, what, a week or two ago in a White House memo? This really does distill so much of the problem. They are much more concerned about, like, very small segments of the population, boutique debates over terminology that bear no resemblance to how most Americans think and talk. They are more concerned about that and adjudicating which words are said and when than they are concerned about the underlying substance of their catastrophic policies. It says it all. It's the Guy Benson Show. Juan Williams is next.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
Halfway through the Monday edition of the Guy Benson Show. Thanks for being here. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast is always free. Joining us now, Juan Williams, Fox News senior political analyst, columnist at The Hill, best-selling author. Juan, great to talk to you as always.
What a delight. Good to be with you, Guy, on this beautiful spring day in Washington, D.C.
It is really, really nice. It was nice yesterday as well. We were on Fox News Sunday together in the morning, and I want to actually call back to our conversation that we had on the air in just a second. Before we do that, though, I know you're a huge baseball fan, and I'm wondering, with the season around the corner here, do you have any thoughts on this Ohtani betting scandal? Because it feels like we have not gotten the full story yet.
That's an understatement. You know, so far what Major League Baseball has done is essentially said that Ohtani is not guilty of anything, that it's all on the interpreter, and the interpreter
Exactly. Right?
Come on. What are you doing? How can you expect me to believe that? I mean, so Ohtani is giving his interpreter access to multi-millions, 4 million plus in his own bank account without any knowledge of what this is about? Well, obviously, you know, I just don't believe that.
No.
I find that incredible or not credible. And I think that what we're on the verge of here is a Pete Rose-like scandal in which there's gambling by people playing baseball.
Yep. I mean, it seems almost unfathomable that the official story thus far is anywhere close to the full truth. And I do think, if people aren't familiar, Ohtani is this mega, mega star Japanese player. He was in Los Angeles, or really Orange County, with the Angels for a long time. Now he's become a Dodger. He's arguably the best overall player in the game. And he speaks not a ton of great English, so he has this interpreter, very, very close with this guy, like best of friends. And the interpreter's been fired because of these allegations involving millions of dollars going out the door in off-the-books, high-dollar, obviously, sports gambling. And the idea that it's just the interpreter freelancing, as you said, with no knowledge of the superstar, using millions of his dollars through this series of cutouts, it seems, with no knowledge of the superstar himself, it just doesn't pass the smell test. So then the question becomes, like, let's say, you know, Ohtani himself is heavily implicated, which is totally plausible. Then what? Because baseball doesn't probably want to really punish someone severely who's such a big figure in the game, who's so talented, who brings in international fans and interest. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how they play it. And I would say the initial credulous response doesn't lead me to believe that they're going to handle this terribly well, but I guess we'll see.
Well, look, I mean, part of this is about the fact that Ohtani brings in not only eyeballs, I mean, people watch his games. The Dodgers are already the top team in the league in terms of attendance, but you would imagine that that number was going to go up with Ohtani there. And certainly, as you pointed out, the international audience is going up. And with the international audience, really what we're talking about is ratings. We're talking about advertising. So he is a money magnet for the legitimate game. Now he has put all of that in jeopardy. If they were to suspend him while they did the investigation, I would say, oh, well, you know, this reminds me of Faye Vincent in the Pete Rose case. Fine. But no, they're not doing that. So far what we've seen is They are essentially insulating him, protecting him.
Yeah, they're buying his scapegoat story.
Exactly.
And maybe,
that's a scandal in and of itself.
Maybe he's telling the truth, right? So maybe it was all the interpreter and they got close through the years and he had access to money and it was all a big crime done without Otani's knowledge at all. Maybe. I'm not closing out that possibility. It's just like, you know, one.
I mean, come on.
I mean, this is like what I keep coming back to. And,
oh, my gosh.
And it's the last thing baseball wants, and yet they're going to have to deal with it. And you mentioned Pete Rose. Last point on baseball. The Pete Rose scandal was definitely before my time. He bet on baseball. It was a huge deal. He denied that he was betting on his own games. It's been this cloud that hung over his career and life and has continued to do so forever. He's been denied access to the Hall of Fame for that reason. Like, this was kind of seen as a bright line for baseball, saying we're not going to tolerate this. But if you have one of the biggest international stars in the sport now potentially knee-deep or neck-deep in this as the big, like, glittering acquisition of one of the major franchises, now I think favored to win the World Series in Los Angeles, I mean, it's just like this perfect storm. And I just have very little faith in Major League Baseball to really handle this properly.
I would, well, you know, so far they have not exactly covered themselves in honor and given us as fans any reason to trust them. But I just want to, before we end this little segment on baseball and corruption, let me just say, all the sports now, because of the spread of legalized betting, I think are at a greater risk of just this kind of catastrophe with regard to the athletes themselves getting involved and wagering on the sport. We've seen
there's so much money involved, and seeing it, like, the coverage, sports coverage, has become so intertwined with the betting side of things. I saw someone tweet, it made me laugh out loud. It was like, this coverage of the Otani betting scandal is sponsored by DraftKings.
That's
right.
Well, you know, it's a little close to us because we're in the media, but boy, you know, you think about ESPN, mm-hmm. you think about some of these major franchises that literally have betting parlors on the grounds of the ballpark.
Yep, they've got it here in Washington, D.C., at the Capitals Arena.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, wow, what is going on? I mean, when I was a kid, and I'm an old man, I'll give you that, guy. But when I was a kid, they didn't want any franchise in Las Vegas. Why? Because it was the home of gambling. So they didn't want it there. They thought it would corrupt the image of the sport. Now the Oakland A's are in Las Vegas.
Well, and NFL has a franchise. NHL has a franchise. They're thriving. So, look, I see arguments on both sides of it. I understand to some extent the appeal of sports betting. Like, I have it in the back of my mind on a bucket list somewhere that one day I will spend the first weekend of the NCAA basketball tournament in Vegas with a set budget for myself. Like, you're going to spend $500 total on betting, post up at a sports bar, have some beers, eat some wings, and just enjoy it. That's something I would like to do at some point. But overall, betting on sports has no actual appeal to me because I care about the sport. If I'm a fan, I care enough already, let alone having like money or financial stuff tied up in it. My passion is just for the game. Maybe that's naive. Maybe that's old-fashioned. But I root because I care about the game and the players and the drama and the fans and the pageantry. I don't need it. I don't need to, like, I don't know, sweeten the pot anymore personally.
Too dangerous.
I'm with you. Where I may not be with you on, and I almost certainly am not, on politics, you and I sat next to each other on the panel yesterday with Shannon Bream, Fox News Sunday. One of the topics that came up was the army of lawyers that the Democrats are deploying around the country to try to deny third-party challengers or third-party candidates or even third parties ballot access to the greatest extent possible. The argument politically being, and it makes sense, if you feel like a third party on the ballot might hurt you or pull away your voters and therefore help your opponent, on a political level, it makes sense to try to limit that access to the ballot. Just nuts and bolts, X's and O's. On the other hand, if the argument from the Democrats, your party, is we are the pro-democracy party and we are fighting for democracy in the face of a threat against democracy in the form of the Republican Party and Donald Trump, we are going to channel our pro-democracy efforts into suing to give the voters less democracy and fewer options on the ballot, I have trouble squaring the circle on the principled, high-minded sort of posturing that we see from the Democrats. Can you square the circle?
Well, sure. They want to win. And that's what politics is about. And remember, you saw a little bit of this out in California, you know, picking up on our previous conversation where you saw Democrats, Adam Schiff, actually put some money and effort into getting Steve Garvey on the Republican side to be the number two finisher in the race and not a Democrat, because that helped Schiff in a runoff election that's coming up. This is just hardball politics. And you see it practiced by Republicans as well as Democrats. And in this case, the Democrats know that a third-party candidate most likely is going to damage Joe Biden and Kamala Harris in their effort to win re-election.
Of course, and I get it. Well, I mean, of course you're right. They want to win, so this is what they're doing to try to win. But that's not the same thing as being pro-democracy. I think to limit voters' options and to attack through litigation democracy in the name of democracy, I get that they want to win. I mean, of course. But putting winning above
argument.
Principle is what you accuse Republicans of doing.
Well, I was about to say, this is a hard argument for Republicans to make. I mean, usually the conversation is in reverse, with the Democrats contending that voter suppression efforts, the actual voters, are being suppressed in terms of their opportunity to vote, mail-in voting, precincts, time for voting, etc. Now you have a situation where the Republicans say, oh, we're crying foul because we see that Democrats are saying that they're going to make an effort to limit ballot access.
Yeah, and limit voters' options, which you could also absolutely call a form of voter suppression. I think a more legitimate form or a more legitimate accusation than some of the things thrown at the GOP in Georgia and elsewhere. We're going to disagree on that point. I just think it's ironic, which is why we raised it on TV yesterday and why I wanted to revisit it here on the radio as well today. Juan, always appreciate your time. We'll see what happens on the baseball front. We'll talk again soon.
Thank you so much, Guy.
That's Juan Williams. On the Guy Benson Show, we'll be right back after this.
In the swamp, not of the swamp. Guy Benson.
Back on the Guy Benson Show. Thanks for tuning in. Well, here's another entry into the ever-expanding file of Joe Biden as a serial fabricator, fabulist, and liar. The Washington Free Beacon has this story, and it dovetails quite naturally with many, many other examples that we have discussed and detailed through the years about Biden just making things up, massively exaggerating or inventing things out of whole cloth. False memories, details that are designed to ingratiate himself to some sort of audience that just aren't true or are wildly implausible or are in fact affirmatively debunked. He keeps going back to the well over and over again anyway. It's very strange. Some of them are weirder than others. Well, here's the latest headline from the Free Beacon. Joe Biden's political origin story is almost certainly bogus. It may land him in legal trouble. For nearly two decades, President Joe Biden has told a story about why he devoted his life to politics. He repeated the tale at the risk of facing criminal charges for lying to a federal agent while speaking to special counsel Robert Hur in October 2023. By the way, just as an aside, this was the special counsel testimony involving the gross mishandling of classified materials, criminal behavior that Biden is clearly guilty of. They decided not to prosecute because, for among other reasons, he's too old and mentally feeble with a faulty memory and diminished faculties. That was what they wrote in the report, part of their excuse not for filing charges against him. But in the course of that whole episode, for example, Biden claimed that Robert Hur raised the issue of his son's death and the timing of his son's death, Beau. And indignantly, Biden at a subsequent press conference asked, how the hell dare he raise the issue? And then the transcripts came out, and in fact, Biden, of course, was the one who raised Beau's death and couldn't remember what year, not even really close, to what year his son had died, which was one of the factors that informed Hur's decision, Robert Hur's decision, not to pursue charges. Like, he can't even remember within a few years when his son died. And of course, he's told many versions of how and where and why his son died. That's a separate issue. He also, Biden said, once again with great indignation, in response to a question from a journalist, that Robert Hur had not accused him of leaking classified materials or giving or providing classified materials to his memoir writer or his ghostwriter. He said, I was not accused of that by the special counsel. Indeed, he was in the special counsel report. So Biden has been a complete mess on this. And now this is just one of the details on one of the tangents Biden went off on. He meandered down this path under oath with the special counsel during this lengthy interview. And it's a version of the story, apparently, that he's told many times, explaining why he became a career politician, why he decided he needed to devote his life to quote-unquote public service. Back to the story. Fresh out of law school and working as a clerk at a high-powered Wilmington, Delaware law firm, Biden, in his telling, was tapped to defend a construction company sued by a 23-year-old welder who, quote, lost part of his, let's just say, genitals, to a fire that broke out when he was working inside a chimney at a Delaware City plant. Thanks to Biden's shrewd legal defense on the construction company's behalf, the injured man lost the case. This is Biden's story. He represented the company against this young guy who was badly hurt, and Biden was so good at his job, so shrewd as a lawyer, the company won and the guy lost. Biden also told a story recently that at one point during law school, I think he told this also in the Hur testimony, that he hadn't done the reading once in class during law school, and he got called on anyway, and his on-the-fly answer was so brilliant he got a standing ovation or something like that from his fellow students. Absolutely something that did not happen. That's not a thing that happens. Oh, wow, what a... He extemporized so well. Let me applaud this man. Get out of here. Anyway... Here's Biden in the testimony talking about this chimney case that he was involved in. Quote, I wrote this memo and son of a bee, it prevailed, Biden told Hur on October 8th. And I looked over at that kid and I thought, son of a bee, I'm in the wrong business. I'm not made for this. Biden said he was so racked with guilt that he concocted an excuse to avoid a celebratory luncheon with one of the firm's named partners, and walked into the public defender's office to ask for a job that very day. It's, quote, the only time I ever lied, Biden told Hur on October 8th, which is hilarious, given everything, but especially this story. Thus began, according to a New York Times report on the special counsel interview, a career that would one day take him to the White House. But, the Free Beacon reports, this story is almost certainly a complete work of fiction. Although Biden did work at the firm, tapped to defend a construction company in the negligence suit, like the one that was described, that case concluded in 1968. Biden was still in law school. And the welder, the young man, won, walking away with more than $2.8 million in 2024 dollars. Over the years, Biden has told different versions of the welder story. So this didn't happen. The case sort of happened. Biden couldn't have been on it because he was still in law school at the time. And the outcome, which he said filled him with so much guilt that he went the other way and went into public service, the outcome was the opposite of what he said. He didn't just tell this story for public consumption. He told it under oath to the special counsel. Now, will he be charged with perjury for that? Almost certainly not. Because it's just more false memory, misremembered ramblings of an old man, which was the excuse in the first place not to prosecute him for other crimes. So don't hold your breath for any perjury charges out of this one, but it's just another example. Biden's own account of why he got into politics is just flagrantly and somewhat hilariously made up. Very much on brand, is it not? Final hour of the Guy Benson Show coming up next. Andy McCarthy joins us when we come back.
Raise your glass to the Guy Benson Show happy hour. Brought to you by the Finnish Long Drink. Finland's most popular alcoholic beverage is taking America by storm. Visit thelongdrink.com. And now, here's Guy Benson.
It's the Happy Hour on the Guy Benson Show. Thank you for tuning in. Appreciate it every day. GuyBensonShow.com, our website, the podcast, it's the whole show on demand, totally free every day, is at that website, GuyBensonShow.com, or at FoxNewsPodcasts.com, or wherever you get your podcast. This hour is sponsored by the Finnish Long Drink. I did indulge in one or two this weekend, as a matter of fact. Why not? The weather was gorgeous. I did drink responsibly, which we encourage you to do. 21 plus only, I fit that bill as well. TheLongDrink.com, TheLongDrink.com for more. Joining us now, Andy McCarthy, Fox News contributor, former federal prosecutor, best-selling author. Andy, good to have you back.
Guy, great to be with you, always.
I want to get into politics in just a second and some of the legal analysis that we love to elicit from you. Before we do that, though, I was talking to Juan Williams last hour. You are also a huge baseball fan. Just your quick initial impressions of the Ohtani scandal, which seems to be brewing. Have we heard the last of this? Are you buying anything close to what the official story is at this point?
I'm not buying the official story, but that's sort of how I'm wired. And I guess the one thing I'd say, Guy, is $4.5 million is a lot of money for this guy because he's very clever. The contract, I think, is like $700 million, but he arranged it so he only gets paid $2 million a year, and the idea is then California won't be able to get its pounds and pounds of flesh because he'll be back in Japan by the time he gets the lion's share of it. So he's obviously, you know, pretty careful with money, and I don't think he'd be too cavalier about $4.5 million.
I tend to agree with you. So if people are like, what is Guy talking about? Why is he asking Juan and Andy about this? It is a massive story in sports leading up to the new baseball season involving what appears to be a gambling scandal surrounding in the neighborhood of and probably directly tied to one of the biggest stars in the game. So I just want to get Andy's take on it. With that, Andy, a couple different things to talk about here today. Number one, there's been a big change in that New York judgment. The civil judgment against Donald Trump. Initially, the judge had given just an eye-popping $454 million bond against Trump, which Trump was going to be apparently unable to meet in order to move forward with an appeal. Now, a five-judge panel in New York has reduced that amount substantially to still a very high number, $175 million, but that's still way, way less than $450-plus million. What's the significance of this?
Oh, it's highly significant. It's actually, Guy, he probably would otherwise have had to post a bond of more like $550 million because the $454 million judgment, which is actually, it's works out to about $355 million with interest running from, I can't remember if the judge made it to 2017 or 2019, but that's how you get to $454. And that interest is accruing every day at $112,000-plus per day. So he would have had to post a $550 million bond to stay enforcement of the judgment while he appeals. And that's why I think they arrived at the number 175. I think that's about a third of what he would otherwise have had to post. It's very significant. I wouldn't read too much into it in terms of whether it suggests that the appellate court has looked at the merits of the case and thinks that the judgment is completely disproportionate. I think they'll ultimately draw that conclusion. But I think just in terms of what was needed to post in the way of stopping enforcement while he appeals, as you just pointed out, this is still an extraordinary amount of money. $175 million. And the other thing is Trump's assets are mostly real estate, and a lot of it is in New York. So it's not like it was going to be going anyplace. And, you know, the idea that Tish James had to start seizing stuff now because maybe Trump would be judgment-proof if she didn't get on with it, I think is just silly. I mean, he's got tons of real estate in New York.
Well, it's also just obviously resistance theater. That's what this is.
Yep.
That's the whole
yep.
point of it. I'm not a reflexive Trump defender. You and I have talked about some of the charges against him. I think some of them are more serious than others. The Mar-a-Lago documents obstruction case comes to mind. Yes, you've got the mitigating circumstances of Biden not getting charged or prosecuted on a similar front. The Hillary Clinton example, I think, is even more apt We've talked about that as well. Just the facts of the case in isolation for Trump, I think, are very bad for him. In this case, the civil case in New York, it looks completely political because Letitia James campaigned on a platform of I'm going to get Trump. Blue voters in New York love that. She then proceeded to get elected and to go about and set about trying to get Trump. And the way that she's done so in this case is to allege this scheme that has no victim, right? The supposed victims in this, in the fraud that Trump has been found liable for, or his corporation, his company has been found liable for, the victims, quote unquote, all said, no, we weren't victimized. We like doing business with him. We would do business with him again. There was no quote unquote crime. I know it's a civil case, but the victim, the crime, it just wasn't there. But they used the law anyway to bury Trump and then this massive judgment from the judge. The whole thing stinks to high heaven. So you've got that as point one. Point two, James, the attorney general, has been taunting Trump on social media about the interest that he owes every single day. She occasionally does that publicly, which again looks highly improper and totally political. And then you have the president of the United States, who usually tries to at least pretend like he's floating above all of this stuff. Oh, well, he's just president. Whatever happens to Trump from the Justice Department or other Democrats, he has nothing to do with it. You've got Biden reportedly cracking jokes at Trump's expense on this exact front at a fundraiser a few days ago. I said on TV yesterday, I think all of that is an extra bad look.
Yeah, I think they're overplaying their hand a great deal. I think had James started to try to seize some of his property, I think people would have – that would have been an important moment in terms of what people think of this whole lawfare campaign. I think a lot of what we discuss, Guy, is kind of abstract. We talk about, like, allegations and complaints and in indictments. It becomes very real if they show up to seize your stuff. And I think, you know, people would have felt very differently about it.
Well, especially because, to jump in, Andy, I recall when this judgment came down, the Associated Press, to their credit, did a whole investigation where they went back through the records, through the decades, and said, we have never seen this law used or applied this way. So it was a novel and unprecedented application of the law where the quote-unquote victims of the fraud said we weren't victimized, and yet this is the outcome that they sought and achieved in a place like New York against Trump.
Yeah, well, this is why I think you were right to mention the crime about like how the punishment doesn't fit the crime, because crime is important in this context, even though it's civil, because we need to remember that this case started as a federal investigation in my old office, the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York in Manhattan. They turned up their nose at it. Ben Bragg's successor as Manhattan District Attorney, Cyrus Vance, spent a long time trying to make this case against Trump. Both he and Bragg looked at it and decided not to bring it, that there wasn't a good enough criminal case.
Right, so the feds and the locals said, we cannot prosecute a crime.
Correct.
Based on these facts.
Right. And then she comes with this monstrous statute, which never has been applied in this context. It's a consumer protection statute that doesn't have any place when you're talking about big bucks transactions between with sophisticated financial actors on both sides of the transaction who do their own due diligence. It's
right.
Just, you know, it's apples and oranges.
So $175 million is the new reduced amount of money that Trump has to post for this bond to allow the whole process to move forward with the appeal. That's still, as you said, an extraordinary sum, but much less than it would have been. It kind of feels like a climb down, frankly. It kind of feels like something of a PR, at least, victory for him, and also a substantive victory because this will be a more attainable number. I almost wonder, for political reasons, would it have, everything is so weird and upside down, Andy, would it have benefited Trump for Letitia James to try to march in with a warrant or something and take the deed to Trump properties in New York? Like, just a totally undeniable black and white example of authority and power run amok. I almost wonder if Trump would have invited those kinds of optics.
Yeah, I think it's hard for you and me to say that, Guy, because it would have certainly helped him politically. But, you know, let's say he doesn't become president, which there's a very good chance he won't, right? He's doing well in the polls, but, you know, he could I still think Joe Biden's the favorite in the election.
Yeah.
And in the end,
it's at least a toss-up.
Well, yeah, but my point is that, like, you know, there's a lot more going on here than politics for him. This is, like, existential for him. And if she starts taking his stuff, whether he ever gets it back is a big question.
Totally fair point. And then there's the criminal side of everything. A development on that front. We'll get to it with Annie McCarthy right after this break. Don't go anywhere.
Same issues, but with a fresh perspective. The Guy Benson Show.
Annie McCarthy, our guest here on The Guy Benson Show. We're talking about a lot of this legal drama surrounding Donald Trump. You've written a piece at National Review within this broader context entitled Trump's Race Against the Clock. Talk about what that looks like.
Well, I think he lost a big round of it today. He did win on the civil side because, as we've been discussing, he's got a much more doable bond obligation now to process his appeal on the civil side. But on the criminal side, as I think all the tea leaves suggested, Judge Juan Merchan, who is presiding over Alvin Bragg's criminal case, the hush money case against Trump, denied Trump's motion to dismiss the indictment on a discovery, on an alleged discovery violation, and also denied his application to postpone the trial for 90 days. So that case is starting 3 weeks from today, Guy, on it's starting trial with commencement of jury selection on April 15th.
And this is the New York City Alvin Bragg case, which, and stop me if this sounds familiar, this is also a novel legal theory where Bragg is taking alleged federal crimes over which he doesn't have jurisdiction and using this weird bank shot into making it a whole series of dozens of New York crimes involving campaign finance violations, like, oh, they paid hush money to the porn star, and those should have counted as expenses for the campaign, and they didn't disclose that, so it's a crime, and we're going to make it a crime in Manhattan somehow. This is the case we're talking about, which has been pretty well flagged by a lot of people across the spectrum as legally quite weak, right? It's been pilloried not just by conservatives. This is the case we're talking about that's moving forward next month?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And unfortunately, I think the fact that it's weak doesn't necessarily mean that Trump will beat the case, particularly in Manhattan, because I think the weaknesses here, Guy, I've tried to like sort of play out what the trial looks like. And what we talk about in terms of why it's weak are really legal arguments that go to whether there should be a prosecution in the first place on this legal theory. I don't think the case is going to look that way to a jury. So, the thing that's happened here is Bragg has taken what should be a misdemeanor at most, falsification of business records transaction, and carved it into 34 felony counts, which are going to be presented to the jury as falsifications of business records that Trump did in order to conceal another crime, which Bragg actually is – it's really his big objective here, a campaign finance crime on the theory that the hush money payment was a federal campaign finance or campaign donation that had to be booked and disclosed. I think he's completely wrong about that, and that's why the two federal agencies that have jurisdiction over campaign finance, the Justice Department and the Federal Election Commission, both looked at this and decided not to pursue Trump.
But right, which is also, that's a callback to what we were just talking about with Letitia James. You had two different entities who could have brought criminal charges against Trump in that case and said, no, the facts don't support this. So they passed, and instead we got this cockamamie lawsuit from Letitia James. Same thing here, where you have the actual binding authorities on the federal level looking at the same facts saying there's not a crime we're going to prosecute, then Alvin Bragg comes rushing in a deep blue city as someone who derives some of his political support from being anti-Trump, says, well, I'm going to turn it into a crime somehow in this city. It feels like this is, whatever you think of Trump, Andy, this is not how the justice system ought to work. And if Donald Trump's last name were Smith and he weren't running for president, and he weren't this big politically polarizing figure, there is a 0% chance either of these avenues were pursued in New York, right? I mean, that's undeniable.
That's exactly right. And you know, the thing I think is really pernicious about this guy, well, there's a lot pernicious about it, but what I'm thinking of in particular is that the federal government agencies that look at this and that have jurisdiction over campaign finance matters have standards that they've developed over the years which guide them in terms of, like, what cases do we prosecute, where do we settle with a civil fine instead of prosecuting, and that sort of thing. Bragg is basically not only taking their job away from them after they've decided not to pursue it, but he's also kind of making up his own standards as he goes along. And what I would suggest to people is, what do you think Alvin Bragg and the media and the Democrats would have said if Trump had paid Stormy Daniels, the porn star at the center of all this, with campaign funds? What if he had taken campaign money and paid the hush money out of that? They'd be screaming for a different reason. And yet Bragg's theory here is that paying Stormy Daniels was a campaign expense.
Right, a secret one that wasn't then reported properly. Andy, last question. We only have about a minute left. Trump, in his press conference today, cited you. He did it on social media as well. He likes a piece that you wrote about Alvin Bragg. You're accusing Bragg of falsifying business records charges. If you would just quickly summarize the nut of that point and why you think Trump is highlighting it.
Yeah, I think it's exactly what we've been discussing, Guy, which is Bragg is telling people he's doing a business records falsification case. But in point of fact, he's actually trying to enforce federal law that he doesn't have jurisdiction over without saying so. So the business records is kind of his screen for doing that. And I just think it's ironic since he's accusing Trump of falsifying what his business records said in terms of reflecting that, what Bragg says is a campaign donation, but what was actually a legal non-disclosure agreement.
Yeah, the transaction with Daniels.
Right.
Yeah, and so it's like its own form of falsification. And if people are curious to read more, since Trump is talking about Andy's work, and we have him here on the show, you can look at nationalreview.com. The latest pieces are called Trump's Race Against the Clock and Bragg Falsifies Business Records Charges Against Trump, both by our guest, Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, Fox News contributor. Andy, we so appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Guy.
The Guy Benson Show Happy Hour returns after this break.
Miss a minute, miss a lot. The Guy Benson Show.
In our first hour of The Guy Benson Show today, Josh Krasauer was our guest. We talked Israel. We talked electoral politics. Great, thoughtful, informed discussion with Josh, as usual. Here's part of it. My zoom-in question is about one race right in this neck of the woods in the DMV in Maryland. I think a real headache for the Democrats is Larry Hogan, the popular two-term Republican moderate governor of Maryland, deciding to seek the Senate seat in that state. And there was polling just last week from the Washington Post that shows at this still very early stage, Hogan is up double digits on either one of the Democrats who might run against him. There's a primary that's active. I think that will tighten. I think he's probably still very much the underdog. He says he is the underdog. Trump will be on the ballot. It's a very blue state. But at least for now, Hogan is showing himself to be, you know, independent and quite popular still in that state. Could be a problem for Democrats. Then there's this little side story right now getting a little bit of attention where the leading Democrat would-be opponent to Larry Hogan apparently used a racial slur on camera during some sort of debate in the legislature. It was a slur that I had never heard of. It took me a while to even figure out what he said because no one was reporting it, just saying it was a slur. I'm like, okay, what was the slur? So I had to do some research and actually find it. It took me a while. A slur that I had never heard of in my life, but apparently a lot of people said, yeah, that is not something that should be said by a white dude, which he is. David Trone is his name. So he said, oh, I actually meant to say this other word, bugaboo, and I said this other thing instead, and I didn't mean it that way. His opponent in the primary is a black woman. This is becoming maybe a bit of an issue for him. You probably, as a Democrat in a primary or otherwise, don't want racial slur attached to your name. Just an interesting little dynamic that, who knows, Josh, could make a really significant difference moving forward when we look at the balance of power flashing forward to November, where Maryland, at least right now, looks like it's on the Senate map for sure.
Yeah, a couple of important points in that race, Guy. This is the worst field of candidates, two candidates, but this is, if you talk to Democrats in Maryland, they are shocked that they have two candidates this week. One of them is the guy you mentioned, David Trone, who is a congressman who is I think he's the wealthiest or one of the wealthiest members of Congress. He owns Total Wine. If you're from the D.C. area, he has a big business that you see in a lot of, you know, shopping malls and shopping centers. So he's basically spending his own money on the campaign. You see ads on DC TV about his campaign and about his, you know, trying to appeal to African-American voters and progressives, and we kind of define his candidacy. The problem is he's not raising any money. He doesn't really have a natural base of support, and his record in electoral politics is that he's spent gobs of money, and he's had tough races even with all that money spent. He lost in a primary once, and he got the seat in the House. But he's not exactly a guy who has a lot of organic political support. In fact, a lot of the Democrats in the congressional delegation have endorsed his opponent, who's Angela Alsobrooks, who no one, if you ask any Maryland Democrat who's not really involved in politics who she is, no one knows who she is. She's a local Prince George's County executive, very little profile. She has a very spotty record as executive in a county that's had some tough times lately. She's had trouble raising money on her own. She's been, you know, usually like African-American candidates are generally like great stories, and you have a lot of great biography to run on. You raise a lot of money. That's been the history with a lot of the candidates, non-white candidates that Democrats have run in recent years. She has not taken advantage of that biography, and she's really not made much of a mark in Maryland. So you have two of these very, very, at best mediocre candidates, if not weak candidates. And then you have Larry Hogan, who's one of the most popular governors in Maryland history, who still has strong job approval or strong favorability based on the Washington Post polling. And, you know, he could be running against two very, very weak, damaged Democratic opponents.
Yeah, now, and I guess the front runner is Trone, this congressman. And I said that it was a Maryland legislature debate. It was the congressional debate where he used this word that apparently is a racial slur. And when you Google his name, as I just did, so many of the headlines are about his apology and clarification on a racial slur as this very rich, like central casting, like rich white guy, right, in a Democratic base that isn't super into that these days. So his female black opponent is trying to make hay of this. But as you said, she's not really very well known and not good at fundraising either. So, I mean, I'm not predicting Senator Hogan is a shoo-in. I think it's still an uphill battle in such a blue state. But if you're going to look at things breaking a certain way to make that happen, so far, so good for the Republicans.
Yeah, I mean, it's something of a perfect storm. And Hogan, by the way, he just left the governorship, and he's been running. He was thinking about running for president on an explicitly anti-Trump, independent-minded platform, no labels. He was flirting with for a long time. So his brand, for anyone who pays attention, is not even really that partisan. This is a part of this like no labels, independent movement, and he's a popular former Republican governor. So you couldn't ask for a perfect storm to put this race more than Hogan has. To put this race in play. There's also the issue of Israel, where, you know, if you follow, Maryland is one of the largest Jewish populations in the country, and Van Hollen, the senator, the other senator in the state, has been very hostile, one of the most hostile senators against Israel and trying to condition aid to the country. So that's another issue that Hogan has been really taking advantage of and campaigning against Van Hollen and trying to be kind of a bridge to the moderates in the state of Maryland. That said, this is one of the most Democratic states in the country, and congressional and federal races become very partisan in the end. So I still would have a hard time seeing Hogan winning in Maryland. But boy, if there's any set of circumstances that puts this race in play, and I do think Democrats are going to have to spend some money here.
My full interview with Josh Krasauer, Fox News radio analyst, available online at GuyBensonShow.com. It's part of our free podcast every day on demand. No charge to you. Absolutely free. GuyBensonShow.com, FoxNewsPodcast.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. When we come back, the home stretch, we have a planned topic, but first, There was a bit of an accident, an issue, a mishap involving producer Christine and her new workout regimen. Uh-oh. I'll ask her about that next.
New talk for a new generation. The Guy Benson Show.
Home stretch, Guy Benson Show. Thanks for being here. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast always free. Well, March Madness, so crazy right now, but unfortunately over for my Northwestern Wildcats. We told you on Friday UConn was going to be a beast, and Northwestern took on the number one team in the country, the number one overall seed in the Huskies last night, got off to a very cold shooting start and just could not recover. Two starters injured, plus a cold shooting night. You're just not going to beat UConn, especially with UConn playing so well in that first half. The Cats actually kept it respectable and close, went on a bit of a run in the second half. Still lost by 16, 17 points. And, I mean, it makes sense why UConn is the favorite to win the whole thing. They are just next-level elite. And Northwestern didn't have the horses to really compete and would have needed to play almost perfectly and would have needed a UConn big underperformance to have a chance. Neither of those things happened. So UConn advances to the Sweet 16. Northwestern is out. And without going too much more into it, I'll just say, as a fan, so proud of the team. Such an exciting, satisfying, thrilling season. And the amount of adversity with those injuries, you sometimes dream, and if you're a sports fan, you can relate. When certain things break against you and you start to wonder, okay, what if that hadn't happened? What if these two guys hadn't gotten hurt? They would have won two or three more at least Big Ten games. Their seed would have been higher. Their path deeper into the tournament easier, at least theoretically. You play those games. And it's not irrational. In fact, UConn's coach, very classy in the post-game interview, made the same point. He's like, look, these guys are injured. Fully healthy, they're probably not even playing us tonight because they're a higher seed somewhere else. I think that's true. But the what-ifs will drive you crazy. You just have to be grateful for what actually happened, the overcoming of a lot of adversity that the Cats were able to pull off, and just the ride of a lifetime from Boo Booey. Agent Zero, number zero in purple, walking off the court, very emotional for the final time in a Northwestern uniform, embraced by the head coach. You could read the lips, just a love fest there. It was definitely kind of tough to watch and poignant, sentimental. I got a little choked up myself. I think a lot of Northwestern fans did. And just want to say thank you to the team, to the coach, to the program, to the players, and we'll see in a post-Bowie era what happens to this team. I'm optimistic, or at least hopeful, that they can make some things happen with the portal and NIL and all this stuff. Still a solid core of guys coming back. We'll see for next year. But I'm just, in the moment, grateful for what just happened in this season. Another really memorable one in what has been overall a record and program history of great futility at Northwestern basketball. So I think gratitude is very important. And then just congratulations to all the other teams that have advanced. I'll be probably rooting for the Big Ten Conference the rest of the way and keeping an eye, certainly, on the tournament, watching the games, just not as invested as I would be, of course, if the Wildcats were still in. Oh, I was looking at flights to Boston, hotels in Boston, just in case, but it wasn't meant to be. And the Cats were just outmatched, outclassed in Brooklyn last night. So because I subjected you guys to so much purple propaganda this basketball season, now that it's over, I just wanted to acknowledge that and, again, publicly talk about my pride in being a Northwestern fan. With that said, it's important now for us to turn to the elite athlete here at the Guy Benson Show. Producer Christine has procured a Peloton bike, as we told you about last week. She did her first ride, which went pretty uneventfully. She enjoyed it. In fact, she was like, oh my gosh, I could have gone even longer. I could be an instructor, as a matter of fact. She does one ride, and she's like, I can be a Peloton instructor. So, Christine, I got a text from you yesterday. It seems like there was a mishap, a little bit of a spill. What happened?
I fell off the bike.
How?
And I really messed up my leg.
How did you fall off the bike? It is like virtually impossible to do that.
I couldn't. I only got out of one shoe on the right. So like, you know,
when
like,
you were done. So you were done with the ride.
Yeah, I was done with the ride and I was trying to get off. So like, you know, like a horse, like you like put your leg over one side. So I was bringing my leg.
Oh, boy, you're bringing up ponies. Really? Sorry, you can't kill the Peloton bike, Christine. It's an inanimate object, but go on with the story, please.
Oh, and I was bringing my leg around because I couldn't get my foot out of the left shoe. And the next thing I knew, I had just completely fallen over. My leg is still my foot still strapped to that left pedal, and I'm on the ground completely.
Uh-huh.
And it hurt.
Yeah. You said that your husband had anticipated this?
So I'm not... I don't always...
Are you a klutz?
Yeah, I don't exercise with grace. Let's just put it that way. I'm kind of clumsy. When I used to do Orange Theory, I...
So when Jesse Waters in his new book talks about how much he hates people who spill and he finds it disgusting, I mean, that must have been uncomfortable for you.
Very, very uncomfortable and very judgy. And I could see, I felt like he was looking at me, even though he didn't even know much about me, but...
He probably knew, just deep down.
It was like scary. I'm like, oh my gosh, like what if I ever spilled in front of, because you don't spill intentionally. You don't fall intentionally. Although, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but I used to throw myself off of carousel and then blame her. My father would come up to give me a riding lesson, but I would throw myself off a carousel and then hold her and say, Dad, she bucked me off.
Oh, like as an excuse to have her killed, which you eventually did
anyway.
No,
I just, so I didn't have to.
This is next level sociopathic.
I just didn't want to, I didn't want to ride her.
Manipulative behavior.
Yeah, so I would literally, I would find where the softest spot of the sand was in the riding ring, and I would just like throw myself off of her.
We're going to find your Peloton machine with like the screen sawed off, aren't we? And it'll end up in the bed next to Bobby as a warning.
Well, anyway, Bobby had set me up on the Peloton before he went food shopping yesterday morning. And it was taking me a while to get the shoes. You know, it's that easy to clip in.
Once you get used to it, it's easy. And there is a method to just unclipping, which takes a second to figure out. But, yes, you're new at this. So he maybe anticipated the issue that you were going to have.
He was worried. And he said, if you're done before I'm back, just sit on the bike. I'll get down there.
Like, don't get off the bike?
No. Just wait.
But you're like, I got this.
Well, I had the first one off. So I'm like,
I'm speedy cookie.
Yeah, this was easy. And the next thing I know,
I was. Once you get the first one off, it's easier.
No, that's not true.
Yes, because then you cross your leg and you exit that side of the bike and just turn your ankle. It's pretty
easy. Well, that's where the problem went. I turned my ankle and then I fell.
No, but you have to deliberately turn it. We can talk about this off
air.
But he said, are you sure you've got this? Don't get off the bike. I'll help you. But you were like, oh, blew that off. I'm good. I'm a speedy cookie. It's fine. And then, in fact, exactly what he warned about happened.
Yes. Exactly what he warned about. And then I was yelling for Megan, but she was upstairs watching TV. She didn't hear me. So I just had to sit there. And then finally, Bobby came home and unclipped me. But
Christine, do
it was
we
bad.
Need to give you one of the I've fallen and I can't get up buttons?
Honestly?
Yeah, it's like almost that time anyway in your life. So maybe it makes sense.
I'm pretty clumsy. When I used to go to Orange Theory, there were some times where you're supposed to climb up onto the bench, you know, like to lift your legs. I fell a few times. So whenever that part of the exercise would come up, the coach would come to me and say, why don't you just do this on the floor and just wait until they get back down?
Okay. Oh, dear. Did you have a good ride anyway, or are you now poisoned?
Oh, I didn't do it this morning, but I will tomorrow. My leg hurts a little bit today, but I really enjoyed it. I did the Allie Love ride, and I loved the Taylor Swift ride. It was good. It was
Allie Love,
great.
Taylor Swift. Which album did you do?
1989.
Okay, yep. So some good music.
Great music.
Good
and
sweat.
Oh, yes. Yes. But we just got to work on, you know, mounting on and off the bike.
Yeah. I think that's fair. And this is only two rides ever. So I actually went to track your progress. I'll admit this. I went to go see how you were doing to see if you had done another ride at all. And turns out Speedy Cookie has a hidden profile. So I couldn't actually track your progress.
How did I do that? I didn't even know I did that.
No, you did it by accident. but
oh.
I'll just have to rely on your word.
I'll tell Bobby to undo whatever I did by accident.
That sounds good. And I can text you a few suggestions moving forward of the next couple rides to do. But are you bruised? Like, are you over?
Yeah, I'm bruised. I have a picture of the fall, too, but I'm not going to share that.
You have what do you mean a picture?
Like, once I was on the ground waiting for Bobby, I just took a picture of myself on the ground. But I will not be sharing that picture.
Oh, I was hoping that Bobby came home and took a photo of you on the ground.
No, he was that worried. He's like, come on, Cooks. He's like, I predicted this would happen, and you told me it would not happen.
Christine, I think you need to tweet this photo, at CookiesJar1988.
No.
At CookiesJar1988, a sneak peek at how Speedy Cookie's doing on the Peloton bike. All right, well, hopefully the next ride that you take will result in no sort of disaster, and you can let me know that update if and when it occurs, but don't take it out on the bike like you did on your pony. We don't need any more violence. Violence is not the answer, Christine. Just pedal through it. That's the key, Speedy Cookie. We'll be back here on the Guy Benson Show tomorrow, same time, same place. Talk to you then. Have a great night.
Jason in the House, the Jason Chaffetz Podcast. Dive deeper than the headlines and the party lines as I take on American life, politics, and entertainment. Subscribe now on foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.